This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Joseph Terrigin is an assistant professor at the American University in Washington, currently writing the biography on Xi Jong-shun, and joins us on the program. Hello, Joseph.
Good morning.
Joseph, firstly, can you tell us how it is that he became a revolutionary?
Sure. So he was born in 1913 in Shaanxi province. And this was an interesting region to grow up because it was near a city that had been a capital for many Chinese dynasties. So there were these glorious ruins, but also for decades it had been an area of bandit warfare and famine. So as he was growing up and he was going to school and he started to meet teachers who were talking about why China needed to change, this had a big impact on him. But we know from materials about the Chinese Revolution in this region, including documents that have become available outside of China, as well as memoirs and Xi Jong-shun's own accounts, when he joined the party when he was 14 years old, he didn't really have a clear understanding of what communism was all about. It wasn't really an intellectual attraction. He was just looking around him and saw a lot of things that he found deeply troubling, and under the influence of these teachers, he decided that he wanted to lead a revolutionary life. And his first act, actually, as a revolutionary, was an attempt to poison a teacher. And when that was unsuccessful, although several teachers that were not targets became sick, he went into prison, which is where he formally joined the Chinese Communist Party when he was only a teenager.
Can we go back a little bit and just talk about what the Chinese Communist Party was like at that time?
Sure. So when he was first becoming interested in the Chinese Communist Party, it was at a moment when the Chinese nationalists, the KMT, and the communists had a cooperative relationship. So in the schools in Shaanxi province, these leftist teachers had some space to communicate their message. But after the KMT and the CCP split, it suddenly became much, much more dangerous for people who wanted to work with the CCP. And it was at that moment when the CCP was crushed in 1927 and 1928 that the party in Shaanxi province started to use these sort of radical leftist dangerous steps as a way to try to lash back out on this crackdown, which is when Xi Jinping's father tried to poison that teacher and was thrown in jail.
How long was he in jail for?
He was in jail for several months, and it was a devastating experience both emotionally and physically because the person who introduced himself into the party was killed shortly after, and his health completely collapsed, and he had all of these skin diseases and couldn't walk. And when he was finally released and he went home, the experience had been so emotional for his father that his father sadly died shortly after.
Where did the relationship and how did the relationship now come about?
So as people who know a little bit about Chinese politics probably know of the so-called Long March, right? So Mao had a base camp in the southern part of China, which was destroyed by the nationalists and had to flee all the way across China to Shaanxi, which is where another base camp had been created, partly with the help of Xi Jong-shun. But what's so interesting about this story is that when Mao and the central organs of the Chinese Communist Party arrived in Shaanxi, Xi Jong-shun was in a CCP prison expecting to be buried alive because of an internal CCP purge. And when Mao came to that province and decided to set up what would become the Yan'an base camp there, he said, stop these purges. We need to figure out what's going on. And Xi was always grateful to Mao for that intervention.
You mentioned purges because purges get mentioned quite a few times and are significant of what's happening within China. Can you explain what the purges were?
Sure. So in 1935, the central party apparatus had sent individuals to Shaanxi and decided that these CCP members, including Leo Jordan, a name that might come up again because it has to do with another purge in 1962 when Xi Zhongxun was cast out of the leadership. That was after the PRC was established. They were seen as not being sufficiently aggressive. They seen as not listening to directions that wanted them to be even more aggressive. And so there was this struggle over policy that these local leaders who thought that they were acting in a practical way were targeted, and some of them were killed, and that's why they were in the CCP prison when Mao and the others from the central leadership arrived.
Was that relationship with Mao significant to him as he progressed through the party?
Absolutely. So Mao also, when he was at the base camp in southern China, had his own struggles with people who he thought were dogmatists, who had these ideological strictures that prevented them from acting in a way that really suited the situation on the ground in China. So in the 1940s, as he was concentrating his authority in Yan'an, he told the story about CCP history as him always having been on the right side, as him always having been able to see how to use communism practically, and he tied his story to the story of Liu Jidan and Xi Zhongxun and their experiences in the Northwest. So the story that Mao told the Chinese Communist Party to legitimate himself and justify himself was partly also a story that portrayed Xi Zhongxun and what he had achieved along with the others in the Northwest as something similar that tied them together.
We should just do a little, like a couple of minutes taking a look at the Chinese history at this time and exactly who the Communist Party are fighting against and how that relationship has occurred.
Sure. So after Mao and the other top leadership arrived in Shaanxi and were establishing the Yan'an base camp, at first, Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists were acting very aggressively in trying to destroy the communists. But famously, because of the so-called Xi'an incident, the KMT and the CCP decided to engage in a united front against the Japanese. So up until about 1945, Xi Zhongxun was first running an area to the south and then to the east of the central leadership in Yan'an, which meant that he was in this sort of liminal world where the KMT and the CCP were sometimes cooperating, sometimes fighting, always trying to edge the other out, which meant that he was always engaged in both physical violence but also political warfare, and it meant that he was always running agents and doing intelligence work and trying to protect those very sensitive border regions. And then in 1945, in the war against the nationalists after the Japanese had surrendered, he fought in the Northwest, which meant that he also played a critical role when the CCP took over Xinjiang, which of course has been in the news. And after the PRC was established, Xinjiang was part of the area in the Northwest Bureau of which he was a leader.
So it was a fight, during the Second World War with Japan, there was also conflict internally between, like, within the Communist Party and then also fighting the Nationalist Party, the Nationalists as well.
Sure. So in the 1940s, we see Mao using that opportunity to establish his own authority within the party and prepare for the battle with the Nationalists after the Japanese had surrendered.
So once the Communist Party is unified against the Nationalists, tell us what happens then as far as war and civil war is concerned.
Sure. So what we see then is originally, interestingly enough, Mao thought that the first major battles against the Nationalists would take place in the Northwest. And that would have given Xi Zhongxun an even more prominent role as a revolutionary. It would have added even more to his prestige and the things he could have taken pride in after 1949. But then suddenly, Deng Xiaoping, who of course became the top leader in China in the 1980s, made a brilliant tactical maneuver that suddenly made it possible to cause trouble for the nationalists in the more central region. So at that point, the Northwest became somewhat, although not entirely, a backwater. But what's interesting, too, is there was a moment in 1947 when the nationalists launched a major attack on Yan'an, and Mao had to flee. And Xi Zhongxun was there encouraging Mao to get out before the nationalists took over. So he was watching and helping and face to face with Mao at this moment when the communists had to leave their base camp where they had been building up their forces for so many years.
Doing a little bit of a lesson in the history of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as taking a look at Xi Zhongxun on the program this morning. Because that's one of the things that we tend to forget, Joseph, is that the Communist Party and their role in China is relatively recent.
I suppose in the sweeping dynastic view of Chinese history, you're right. They came to power in 1949, and it's only this year, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, that they were celebrating the 100th anniversary of the establishment of the party.
When you take a look at Xi Zhongxun's influence, and you were talking about his role within Mao, how influential was he, especially around that time of the revolution itself?
Sure. So during the revolution, people took great pride in what they were able to achieve because they had dedicated their entire lives to this Leninist organization. So how others saw them, how others saw their legacy, had everything to do with their own sense of self-worth. And then after 1949, the hierarchy within the leadership, to a significant extent, reflected views within the party about how much you were able to achieve, the contribution you had made to the revolutionary project. So not just Xi Zhongxun, but everyone after 1949 really, really, really cared about party history because it had to do both with their own sense of self-worth and also what positions they might be able to lay claim to after the PRC was established. So Xi Zhongxun was someone who had helped create this base camp, and that base camp was what saved the Long March and also served as a springboard for the revolution afterwards. And then from 1945 to 1949, he was a top civilian leader in the Northwest. And we know that for the rest of his life, he was very jealously concerned about how people evaluated that role and how important it was. But by the 1950s, he was sort of the right-hand man to Zhou Enlai, the premier, a name I think is familiar to most people. And by 1959, he was officially a vice premier, which put him in the very center of the leadership. And interestingly enough, by far the youngest vice premier.
Was he, because when just reading and taking a look at his life, he wasn't necessarily a confrontational leader as well. He tried to find ways to resolve problems not through violence.
So what's interesting about his career, especially between 1949 and 1952, is that he displayed a capability for combining political pressure, an open hand, but also we shouldn't underestimate the extent to which there was also a sort of fist in a velvet glove, mm-hmm. where he would combine this threat of violence and the potential for using a force, sometimes very effectively with the sort of political offensive. So we see that we see him use that a lot in the early years of the PRC, especially vis-a-vis what the PRC would call bandits, although that's obviously a very value-laden term, but essentially were these local chieftains that were not Han Chinese. He did display at least sometimes a sensitivity and a capability for using both of those two approaches simultaneously at the same time. And that was also something that caught Mao's attention. Mao at one point said that because she was able to convince a chieftain to surrender without using force, that he was even more wise than Zhuge Liang, a famous character from the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, who was known for his brilliance as a tactician.
Because it's interesting that he had a relationship with the Dalai Lama, or there was a recognized relationship between them, which you don't necessarily associate with in China.
Well, what's interesting about that is in the early years of the PRC, the area now known as the Tibet Autonomous Region had cadres who had been sent from the Northwest Bureau, where Xu Zhongxun was leader, as well as leaders who had been sent by the Southwest Bureau, which was led by Deng Xiaoping. And the cadres from the Northwest Bureau that were close to Xu Zhongxun were closely allied with the Panchen Lama, whereas Deng's former lieutenants were allied with the Dalai Lama. So for a lot of the 1950s, Xu Zhongxun was a sort of ally of the Panchen Lama, and I wouldn't quite say foe, but someone who was more skeptical of the Dalai Lama, whereas Deng Xiaoping was a much more clear friend of the Dalai Lama. Having said that, so I think saying that they were close friends in the 1950s overstates what exactly was going on. However, in the 1980s, there were these very interesting discussions between Dharamsala, obviously, of course, after the Dalai Lama had left China, and the chief Chinese interlocutor during those negotiations was Xu Zhongxun. And we have records of those talks that show that Xu Zhongxun was someone who at least demonstrated a capacity for negotiation, an open mind, and emphasized the importance of those talks and supported them as they continued. So there's a very interesting connection with Tibet there.
John joins us. Hello, John.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yes, John.
I'd just like to ask the gentleman, after the revolution in 49, I believe that the Mao had to gather his forces again, back again, and go internally into China and fight a war against some warlords there that had massive armies to liberate China, even though they'd won they'd beat the Kuomintang in the battle for the control of China. Then they had to go back in and fight these warlords, and some of them had massive armies.
Can we talk about that, Joseph?
Sure. I had a little bit of trouble hearing the listener, but I believe the question was about how Mao used the war with Japan as a moment to build up his forces for a later struggle with the nationalists. And I think that's true. And in fact, the course of Chinese history, it's hard to underestimate the importance of the Japanese attack for ultimately the opening that the Chinese Communist Party was able to use to ultimately come to power. And Mao, when you read his transcripts with outside leaders, he often has these sort of ironic or wry turns of phrase, and he once thanked the Japanese for the attack, for giving the opportunity to the Chinese Communist Party to ultimately come to power.
If we take a look at the role that Xu Zhongxun had within the party in the 1950s, how important was it to be part of the propaganda department?
So Xu Zhongxun was briefly head of the propaganda department. And what's interesting about that is this was an individual who didn't have a lot of formal schooling. So after the incident when he was a teenager and he was arrested after trying to poison those teachers, that was when he was 15 years old. So for someone like that to go and become head of the propaganda department, he himself admitted that he was a little bit surprised by that assignment. And, you know, in the early years of the PRC, in terms of what the propaganda department was doing, it wasn't quite as conservative as later on. And there was a little bit more opening for creativity. But Xu Zhongxun also at that time talked about how China needed to study Soviet socialist realism. But he's remembered as having a little bit of a lighter hand, although that had a little bit to do with the broader nature of Chinese politics at the time he was in that position.
Were there divisions within the Communist Party in China about which type of communism they should be taking on, whether or not they should be taking a closer look, as you just said, with what's happening in Russia, or that it needed to be a different type of communism for China?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, and one that also speaks to the role of Xu Zhongxun in the 1950s. So in the 1950s, the Soviet Union and China had an exceptionally close relationship, and the Soviet Union sent experts to China to help them develop up their military, develop their industry, improve their science and technology. And the person who was in charge of managing those Soviet experts within China was none other than Xu Zhongxun as part of his bailiwick on the State Council. So he would have been front and center to see just exactly how much the Soviets could contribute, but also all of these interesting tensions about that these experts faced and, you know, moving to a country where the cultures were so different and there were these, you know, nationalist sentiments on the Chinese side and big questions about, you know, how direct the Soviet model could be applied to China. And then ultimately, of course, by 1960, when Mao split with Khrushchev, all of those experts were removed. And after Mao had decided that this scientific bureaucratic approach to development that had become the norm in the Soviet Union was inferior to what he thought better suited where he wanted China to go, which was this mass mobilization and propaganda and agitation and riling up the population as opposed to this careful scientific bureaucratic approach that he saw in the Soviet Union and which he thought was dangerous to the values of China and also wouldn't be able to allow them to move quickly enough in the direction he wanted.
Was Xu Zhongxun seen as a possible leader of the party or at least being a high-ranking official within the party?
So precisely because he was the youngest vice premier in the 1950s, and also because he was the youngest top bureau chief to be brought to Beijing in 1952, he was always seen as someone with exceptional promise, someone who was always ahead of other people within his generation, and potentially someone who could serve as an important role ultimately later in the succession. And then in the 1980s, we see Xu Zhongxun returning to Beijing after the Cultural Revolution. But again, he was only given a sort of right-hand man position. Then he was on the secretariat working for Hu Yaobang, who was the general secretary. And we know that he was always considered for higher positions, but he never quite reached there, which may have been some reason for resentment. But also interestingly, in the 1980s, because he wasn't quite as old as the old guard, but he wasn't quite as young as the people who were moving to the so-called front line. He played a crucial role in picking and empowering younger people in their 30s and 40s and 50s to move into key positions in the provinces, one that was a very sensitive, very controversial position that earned him some enemies, but gave him a really interesting function in terms of this dangerous succession story during the 1980s.
What was his career like after the Cultural Revolution?
So interestingly enough, the very first job that he was given after the Cultural Revolution was in Guangdong province. So imagine for a moment you've spent 16 years in the political wilderness and suddenly you're sent to a province that borders Hong Kong. And people describe what he saw on, you know, one side of in the PRC looking into capitalist this capitalist society and being stunned about how far China had fallen behind. And he would be meeting with these people, local brigade leaders whose workers were all fleeing into Hong Kong, and he would ask them, you know, why are people going to a place where they would all be exploited? And it was very carefully explained to him, well, you know, there's not money to be made here, there's not a lot to eat. And the first great crisis that he faced as leader of Guangdong were these massive migration waves into Hong Kong. It was a major crucial issue between the United Kingdom and China at that time. And in fact, his first trip overseas while he was in Guangdong was to Australia, where according to the Australian archives that I've looked at, he was quite impressed by how developed Australia was. And the reason he visited was he was establishing a sister province relationship between Guangdong and New South Wales.
Well, we should go back to just to talk about why he was jailed during the Cultural Revolution.
Sure. So, interestingly enough, he was removed from power several years before these huge swaths of the leadership were persecuted at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution in 1966 and 1967. He was purged actually in 1962. And the reason for that, interestingly enough, was a novel. The trigger was a novel. And this novel was about Liu Jidan, the CCP leader that I mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast as another individual who had served in the Northwest. And this novel appeared at a very, very, very dangerous moment because the Great Leap Forward had ended and the steps were being taken to address the problems that it had created. And Mao had approved them, but over 1962, he decided that those trends were dangerous. And so this novel, for complicated reasons, was seen as a challenge to this general direction that Mao wanted the party to go. So Xi Jinping actually saw his father removed from power much earlier than most of the rest of the leadership a few years later when the Cultural Revolution started.
Did that affect him, Xi Jinping?
So what's very interesting is at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution, the famous Red Guards, the so-called first-generation Red Guards, were primarily so-called princelings, meaning the offspring of top officials. And they wanted to demonstrate how red they were. They wanted to demonstrate their genes. They wanted to their red genes. They wanted to demonstrate that they were the successors to the revolution. So for Xi Jinping, he would not have been able to participate in that, which almost certainly was galling for him. But it also meant that, you know, as a young person, a teenager when the Cultural Revolution started, he would have been in a long period of political danger, so to speak, right, where he would have seen these roving street gangs fighting, this factionalism. The school that he at which he studied was essentially raided by a competing group of young people. So it was certainly an emotionally difficult situation for everyone, but I think especially for him, whose father had been removed even years before that, because first he couldn't participate, and then also he would have been personally experiencing this extraordinary political and even physical violence.
Just on Xi Jinping, just for a second, just on that, does that make it more interesting how he managed to rise to power given what happened to his father?
So Xi Jinping is a princeling, but he is a unique princeling, right? So partially because of what happened to his father in 1962. But his father also played a role that sometimes helped and sometimes hurt Xi Jinping. So, for example, Xi Jinping's first job after he graduated from university was as a secretary to a top military official who had served with Xi Zhongxun during the revolution. However, a few years later, when he was a local official, Xi Zhongxun called the top provincial party boss and basically said, you know, keep an eye on my son, I hope you'll help him, which was clearly a nepotistic act. And this person did not decide to help Xi Zhongxun and Xi Jinping. In fact, he announced what Xi Zhongxun had attempted to do at a party meeting, and Xi Jinping had to leave that province and go to another one. So it was a case of Xi Zhongxun trying to help his son, but ultimately causing the opposite.
Does Xi Zhongxun then rise again through the party after he comes back and he's spent that time on the border of Hong Kong? Does his rise through the party then begin again?
Right. So after he's in Guangdong province, he then returns to Beijing, where he works on the secretariat, which is a sort of brain of the Chinese Communist Party, for lack of a better metaphor, working as the top individual with Hu Yaobang, who was the general secretary of the party and an individual widely seen as a reformer. And in that job, even though he spent a lot of time managing the so-called daily affairs of the secretariat, he also had his own special bailiwick, which included Tibet, Xinjiang, the United Front, religion, in a variety of other very interesting areas.
When you take a look at what he managed to achieve and his role within the party, how would you see that?
So this was an individual who had created this base camp that essentially played a profound role saving the revolution, because when the Long March started, they didn't know that they would find that base camp in the Northwest. And if it hadn't been there, they would have found it extremely difficult to find another place to set up, and were even thinking of moving farther north towards the Soviet Union. And then when he was in Guangdong, he was also proud of having played a role in the establishment of the so-called special economic zones. And this was something that he always took enormous pride and had seen this as a clear achievement for which he could take great pleasure. But then in the 1980s, you know, after he returned to Beijing, he was associated with these liberal policies on Tibet, on Xinjiang, on how to manage relations with the non-CCP parties that had been allowed to remain and exist within the PRC. And all of those demonstrated this idea that to solve these problems, you needed to overcome the radical excesses of the Cultural Revolution. But by 1989, with Tiananmen and a series of other incidents, the view within the party decided that to solve these challenges to the regime, the key wasn't to overcome the problems created by the Mao years, but to take a sort of stronger approach, a tougher approach, which meant that a lot of these policies with which he and Hu Yaobang had been associated were moved away from.
So was he considered at that time to be too liberal within the party?
So interestingly enough, in 1987, when Hu Yaobang, the general secretary, was removed from the party, there was a what was called a party life meeting, which meant that all of these top figures had to come together and talk about why Hu Yaobang needed to go. And it was seen as a very undemocratic, unfair sort of hack job to create this narrative of Hu Yaobang having done all of these terrible mistakes, right? And Xi Zhongxun, since he was so closely associated with Hu Yaobang, he also had to do a self-criticism because he was part of that leadership. And in fact, some people at that meeting said that he had gone even farther than Hu Yaobang did. So he was certainly associated with those policies and was criticized for that.
Did they still have purging then? And if they did, would he have been purged yet again?
So what's interesting about the 1980s, right, is you've definitely moved away from the Maoist, late Maoist model. I say late Maoist because Mao, there was many different Maos, right? And in fact, many times during his career, he demonstrated an ability to unite the party and not punish former opponents. But certainly during the Cultural Revolution, when you were removed from power, you could be sent to a cowshed, you could be sent to jail, you could be persecuted to death. But that had changed by the 1980s. And in fact, when Hu Yaobang was removed from power, he remained on the Politburo, right? He wasn't incarcerated or anything like that. But you could be on the losing side and get into trouble if you didn't play your cards right. And there were lots of individuals who, for one reason or another, whether it was because of a personal grudge or because of a policy contest, ended up having to go and do something else other than what they had been doing. They wouldn't go to jail if they weren't executed, usually.
Usually. What do we see when you take a look at Xi Zhongxun and then take a look at Xi Jinping? What similarities, if any, are there between them as leaders?
Yeah, so this is a difficult question to answer, because looking at Xi Zhongxun, my approach isn't to say, look how great the father was and how bad the son was, or look how bad the father was, maybe this tells us something about the son, but to use the life of Xi Zhongxun to teach us about modern Chinese history, and especially what it meant to be a revolutionary and then a high-ranking member of the party. But necessarily, it raises questions about what it would have meant for someone to be an offspring of a high-ranking leader in general, but also the son of Xi Zhongxun in particular. So lots of people have said that Xi Jinping is aggressive, is a hardliner, and is therefore moving away from his father's legacy. And in fact, a lot of people had higher hopes for him precisely because of the views that they had of the father. But I think Xi Jinping as an individual is someone who, you know, grew up looking at how much his father had suffered both before 1949 and after 49, but who by all accounts hadn't lost any faith in the party and was devoted to it. And in fact, in some cases, almost took a kind of pride in what he had gone through to demonstrate to people that it had even made his belief in the party even stronger. So I think Xi Jinping is an individual who doesn't want to be the one who is at the wheel when everything that his father and his father's generation had put together falls apart.
Do we know if Xi Zhongxun wanted to reach higher ranks within the party than he did?
Some evidence does suggest that during the 1980s, rumors persisted within the leadership and in Hong Kong and in Western capitals that there was a strong possibility that Xi Zhongxun would become a higher leader, that he would either become general secretary or head of the National People's Congress. Imperfect evidence suggests that he did think that he would be an appropriate candidate for those jobs. But it certainly is the case that given what he had achieved earlier in his life, that he would have had the legitimacy to lay claim to one of those positions.
Joseph, thank you for telling us a little bit about him today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me on to talk about Chinese elite political history.
Joseph Tarigian, assistant professor at the American University of Washington, joining us on the program this morning, currently writing a biography on Xi Zhongxun. This is Overnights on ABC Radio.